Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Daytona Beach International Airport, offering new nonstop service to New York City and Boston, Massachusetts, beginning December 4th. Daytona Beach International Airport features convenient access to the terminal, easy and close parking, and more. Details at flydab.com.
It is devastating to families and communities when a teen takes their own life. Last week, three students in the Seminole County School District committed suicide. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. On today's program, we'll hear voices from Central Florida that are looking to confront the trends that are leading teens to commit self-harm and suicide. Also, UCF's Institute for Economic Forecasting released their predictions for the region's economic health through 2028. We'll speak with the report's author, and later, a pair of siblings have turned their COVID quarantine project into a stage production. The Brackett brothers join Engage. But first, Central Floridians were stunned by the news that three students in Seminole County's school district had taken their own lives within the same week. Two 15-year-olds and a 16-year-old from different schools within the community. CDC data shows that in 2023, nearly 40% of high school students experienced persistent feelings of sadness and hopelessness. The same report indicates 20% of students seriously considered suicide, with 10% actually making an attempt. There are many organizations addressing this by making available many resources for teens experiencing mental distress or simply looking for a mental respite. Allie's Hope in Altamont Springs is one of those organizations. The nonprofit seeks to improve the quality of life for adolescents and young adults living with mental health concerns through education, support, and advocacy. Allie's Hope is named for Allison Gallagher, a Lyman High School graduate who took her own life in 2007. Her mother and father founded the organization after her passing to help make sure teens and families don't have to share in their experience. Joe Gallagher joined Engage to share Allison's story, and a brief warning. This conversation does contain material of a sensitive nature.
Allison was very, very vibrant, very active as a child growing up. She played basketball from first grade up until about 11th grade in high school and was very, very athletic, very fun, had a lot of friends. She had two interests. One was sports. And the other was art. And later on in her life, she really gravitated to the art. And that was a way for her to truly express herself and to really cope with some of her issues that she was having at the time.
Was that something you could see in her art?
Yes, I could definitely see that. One of my favorite pieces was she had gone to a junkyard and got a radiator that was all bent up, brought it home, and drew a man's face in there. So she really had an eye for the abstract. And like most artists, she's never really pleased with what she was doing, but she was, in my opinion, very, very gifted and very talented from that standpoint.
When did you start to see changes in her behavior and what did those look like?
I'd say from first grade to eighth grade, I would consider her just a normal young child, a lot of friends, very active. AB student. Something happened going from her eighth grade year to high school. And what we really thought was, you know, hormones was really the early stages of her having some mental health concerns. You know, she started acting out, being a little more aggressive, a little more defiant. And once again, typical signs that you would see in any teenager as they're trying to find themselves. With her, though, I say they never get any better, just continued getting worse. And so much so that, you know, one of the things that I tell people is that Helen and myself were always involved. I coached her basketball team all the years that she played up until high school. And so we were there every single day, every night. But the people that saw it first were the teenagers, her friends. They saw the changes in her, and I think it kind of really freaked him out or scared him at the time, because she ended up replacing her friends with other friends that were, I guess, a little more suspect.
This first group of friends, were they communicating their concerns with you?
They were not. I'm sure they were communicating with her, but they weren't communicating with me. And honestly, that was one of the reasons why, as we progressed into setting up Alley's Hope, was really having peer-to-peer type of program, because the kids are very astute and given the opportunities, we'll really discuss with the kids and talk to them about what's going on in the world. But when you're talking 18 years ago, you know, there was still some stigma as related to mental health, and it kind of turned some people off.
Talk about the environment that she surrounded herself leading up to the events in 2007.
Well, as she finally got through high school, she got through high school, graduating from Lyman High School, really her friends went from a large group down to a handful. And she continued to kind of isolate herself, where she was starting to experience schizophrenia, hearing voices, and then having wild mood swings like bipolar. And so she was dealing with both of those. And as that was progressing, she became basically isolated to herself.
Was she still engaging in art and sports, the things that she had demonstrated an interest in?
She gave up sports altogether, but she did really enjoy art. So that was her way to truly express herself, was through art. She also, even for as sick as she was and as we could see her, she had a big heart. You know, she wanted to always help people. So that was something that she continued to try to do even when she was sick. She ended up making a decision that she wanted to postpone college. So she ended up getting a job at a fast food restaurant. But then really right after high school, things got a little worse. And we ended up with Altamont Springs Police Department finding out that Allison had some issues, and we ended up having her Baker acted, and she went over to South Seminole Hospital, where she started first of many stays at the hospital, not just that one, but Lakeside, which is now Aspire, and a couple other behavioral centers. So her first diagnosis was schizophrenia, and then they ended up diagnosing her about a year later with being bipolar, and then really combining the two with schizoaffective. So a lot of her time was dealing with that after high school on her health. And mind you, being an athlete and still being fit, you know, she weighed about 125 pounds, solid as a rock. But then as we started dealing with the different illnesses that she had, some of the medicines that she was taking really ballooned her from 125 to over 200 pounds. So not only were we dealing with the mental health issues, but she was also dealing with the fact that she had basically ballooned up because of the meds. Even today, body imaging is a big issue when you talk to the high schoolers. They're concerned about what other people think.
So you've described some of the resources that you, as a parent, tried to access. Were there resources available to her for that she could take advantage of?
The first organization or help that we got was through National Alliance of Mental Illness. And my wife searched them out. They had family-to-family classes, which really helped Helen and myself understand what was going on. And they also had some peer classes that was kind of a hit and miss with Allison. It was kind of a roller coaster. Even though we had been trying to get her help, that wasn't really a very productive avenue for us. She would get on her meds, feel better, and then I make a determination that she really didn't need the meds. And at that point, we get off the meds, and it became a vicious cycle for us. So, you know, our biggest outreach was Lakeside Behavioral Center, or Aspire at the time, that they actually had some social workers and case managers that actually would come to our house and talk to her and communicate with her, which was a huge step at the time. But once she showed signs of improvement, that would stop, and then she'd end up falling back into a pattern. And she's 21 years old and just becoming very frustrated with what's going on in her life. And I think that's ultimately what led to her making a decision that she wanted to end things. And she was at peace with it in herself, when she made the decision. Helen and myself actually thought that she was turning the corner and that she was showing positive signs of improvement, some good interaction with us. I remember the conversation we had the weekend before she passed away. I'm telling my wife, boy, I'm really seeing some positive signs here. And Allison actually had the last several years of her life really had taken a lot of anger and frustration out on me as a scapegoat and would use Helen as the comforter. But she really came up to me about 2 days before she passed and let me know how much she loved me in a way that she had not been able to express for several years. And actually told me, you know, Dad, you can give me a hug, which was kind of like one of those things that had not happened in about 3 years, that she did not want any hugs or anything like that. So that was kind of one of my last memories of positive memories. And I think in a way she was saying, you know, Dad, I'm at peace with what I'm going to do. And I want you to know that I do love you. And it wasn't anything that you did that caused this. And then she took her life a month shy of her 22nd birthday. And it just kept going back and forth with Helen and myself that, you know, was there more that we could have done? You know, I had was sitting on the board for Lakeside Behavioral Center because at that time I felt like, okay, the best help that I can give my daughter is to be on the inside. I'm not a mental health counselor, but if I can be right there where care is being given, maybe we can do something.
What Joe Gallagher built was Allie's way to help other families. One of their initiatives is the creation of hope hubs in schools, safe spaces where students can relax, decompress, talk with others, and even produce a podcast. The first hope hub was opened earlier this month at Lyman High School, Allison Gallagher's alma mater. One of the drivers of teen depression is social media, the 24/7 all-access and anonymous nature of platforms like Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook create a never-ending cascade of negative feedback loops. So much so that last year, the Florida legislature passed House Bill 3, prohibiting teens under 14 from establishing social media accounts. A federal judge put a temporary hold on the law's enforcement in June due to First Amendment issues, pending further review. Marnie Stallman is the president and CEO of the Mental Health Association of Central Florida, and she sees the direct correlation between social media and cell phone usage and the mental health of children as young as 9. Stallman explained to Engage why she feels HB3 is a step in the right direction.
There has definitely been a digital overload, and I think the pressure of creating online identity that exists today that is very different and unique from even 5 or 6 years ago. The constant connectivity creates pressures on our youth to maintain almost what we would refer to as a curated online persona, which causes all kinds of difficulties, obviously, when they try to pursue that. Obviously, there's also cyberbullying, the fear of missing out, and also the digital fatigue, I think, all go into those growing concerns. I had the opportunity to serve on the disciplinary task force for Orange County Public Schools almost 2 years ago, where this topic was brought up about the restriction of cell phone utilization on the campuses. And I voted in favor of that. I am a mom. My daughter is 17. She's a student in Orange County Public Schools. And I can tell you from just self-experience that she's reported not just better interactions with her peers, but a better opportunity that she has had to be more engaged and what I would call present in the moment, and has appreciated the reprieve of that constant bombardment that the social media elements present when you have access to those digital devices that are in your hand 24/7.
So what is a sign or a red flag, both for the youth and for the people in their life, that they're in too deep, that this has become too consumptive, and not just too consumptive, but destructive?
Well, one of the most serious red flags that I think a teen may be is when they begin to talk about the hopelessness or talk about wanting to disappear. And this can kind of show up in some very direct ways, you know, where they're saying, I wish I wasn't here. I wish I was somewhere else, or everyone would be better off without me, or I just want it all to stop. And it can be quite destructive in many cases.
Talk to me about the growth of youth athletics, the pressure that places on students. Creating a lifestyle out of youth athletics is putting extreme pressure on these kids.
Yeah. Well, certainly the performance anxiety, and I think the perfectionisms that athletes often feel, this intense pressure to win, to improve their stats, to meet expectations from their coaches and parents and peers, often leads to chronic stress and fear of failure and a distorted sense of their self-worth tied solely to the performance. And then when you kind of bring on now the name, image, and likeness, the NIL pressures, as that marketability increases as they move on from high school to college, I think it can be really quite intense. You know, our athletes are taught to push through pain, to tough it out, which can oftentimes discourage athletes, particularly in appropriately understanding and expressing where they are emotionally, because they've been told to push down, and those sports become their primary identity. And then we talk about setbacks and injuries that can trigger depression, isolation, and identity crisis, as they, you know, everything is wrapped up into that persona.
Now, bringing this back into the impetus for this discussion, unfortunately, is that, you know, these cases out of Seminole County, and I don't want to dwell on any of the factors in the individual stories here, but when you see three students within a week, within the very same age range, within the same geographical region, what is your reaction?
I think what is unfortunate is that these three occurred so closely together, but the average rates of suicide in the United States right now are 125 deaths per week across the country, ages 10 to 24. So that's about 6,500 a year. And what I think is startling and about this occurrence is obviously that they occurred so closely together, but unfortunately, because it made the media, we're hearing about it. But the unfortunate truth about this is that suicides are occurring all around us on a weekly basis within this age group.
And I think one of the myths that go with that is when this happens to children that exist on the social fringe, that are heavily bullied, that might come from a specific economic sector or race even, that this is something that only LGBTQ kids do. We're not seeing that. This is a broad spectrum.
No. When the Mental Health Association was founded in 1946, its original name was the Central Florida Hygiene Society. And for a very long time, we kind of scratched our heads and thought, what a peculiar name. And now in 2025, at the cusp of celebrating our 80th anniversary, I think they actually got it right. It is hygiene. It's health hygiene. It's no different than our primary health hygiene, our dental hygiene, and our mental hygiene. And that means it's across the board. It doesn't discriminate. When you get a cavity, it doesn't care what your race, your gender, your ethnicity, your sexual orientation. It's a cavity. And when we talk about our mental health and our mental hygiene, it's similar in the fact that while there may be unique pressures and anxieties for any one of those groups I just mentioned, the effects are similar in that anxiety and depression is pervasive. And when we don't address it, when it is buried silently by stigma and fear of judgment, and we don't recognize warning signs or create opportunities to encourage help-seeking behaviors, we get these very unfortunate results where people harm, hurt, or ultimately take their own lives.
And you said the S word, stigma. It's very rational to compare mental hygiene to dental hygiene. You wouldn't hesitate to tell a friend, a coworker, that you're taking lunch to go get your teeth cleaned. We're not as apt to say that about seeking mental aid. So how do you break through that stigma, especially when you're talking about young people who are so sensitive to social reaction.
Yeah, so I'm going to offer three potential things to consider about answering that question. The first is to be a listener without judgment. That's to create a safe space where the child or the youth or anyone can feel heard and not evaluated, right? That we need to let them speak freely without interrupting or rushing in to fix things. I know as a parent, I try to be a fixer. I want things to always have a positive outcome, and that's not realistic. And so listening without judgment and validating that their emotions are real, even if they're not fully understood by you, is the first step. I think the second is that we have to learn to be honest and age appropriate. Children and our youth know when adults are withholding information, and we need to speak truthfully about difficult topics like mental health and loss and use language that's age appropriate, avoiding vague reassurances and euphemisms, and sharing what our feelings are about and how we're managing it and showing that level of vulnerability, I think, is another significant way to not just create a healthy emotional expression or model, but to impact stigma. And then the third is to reinforce the support and safety that the child needs to be aware of, and reminding them that it's okay, as we say here, to not be okay, and that resources, counselors, adults, hotlines, 988 are there to help when they need it, and that seeking help isn't a sign of weakness, it's a sign of strength. And that means modeling, that means showing by example and doing. And that can be hard for adults, particularly parents, you know, where we're maybe afraid to show that vulnerability. And our kids, I think, are desperately looking for it.
Marnie Stallman is the president and CEO of the Mental Health Association of Central Florida. Another nonprofit is addressing the teen mental health crisis through collaboration. Project Overdose is well known in the region for its advocacy for addiction treatment and mental health access. We spoke with them last year about expanding access to Narcan to prevent opioid deaths. This week, they partnered with former Florida State Representative Dick Batchelor to introduce Breaking Through, an initiative focused specifically on the mental health of Gen Z and Gen Alpha, people under 30 that were born into social media and the internet. On Monday of this week, Dick Batchelor and Project Overdose held a roundtable discussion at Orlando's Citrus Club, looking at ways to engage these generational cohorts and normalize and destigmatize mental health care. On Tuesday, Batchelor and Project Overdose's Amy Armstrong joined Engage in studio to talk about how the Breaking Through initiative will connect with the communities of Central Florida. Armstrong began our discussion by explaining what makes members of Gen Z and Gen Alpha unique and especially vulnerable to mental health issues.
They have had social media from day one. They have had technology readily available. They are not going outside. They're not playing as much. They're not having relationships like we all used to have. And so this is the absolute root of why they are now suffering.
We've asked this question on this show before. Is this a bell that can be unrung, or is this a cultural standard now?
Yeah, I think it's a cultural standard. Can it be unrung? No, but it can be addressed, you know, individually. Nationwide, you know, we're going to be working with some organizations in Washington that's going to convene. They are going to convene around this issue to kind of say we can fund some research on how do we deal, what are the inordinate reasons that these kids are having these issues. And last thing I'll point out is that we're also looking at the behavioral model. You know, is what is being provided today to these kids the appropriate behavioral model they need? So we are going to be involved with the national organization and look at nationally at the whole prototype of Gen Z population, their behavioral health needs. Are they different? And if so, can we address those, and can we get funding for it?
So Amy, okay. You know, within those observations that Dick's talking about, what traits are we looking for that would raise the red flags within these generational cohorts?
So what's happening is they are focusing so much on being on their phones instead of having real conversations and real relationships, instead of going outside and playing like we all did when we were younger. They would rather sit on their computers or their phones or their tablets and play games or talk virtually with one another. And so the relationships are not going any deeper. And what's happening is it's causing everyone that is, you know, involved in this behavior, they're sad. They have no hope. And what happens if you don't have any hope?
Right.
You don't want to live anymore. And this is what's causing these youths to want to take their lives.
And Amy, we've heard about efforts within the state of Florida and locally especially to help beef up some of these services in schools. At the same time, we saw $1 billion cut in May from the federal government for scholastic mental health services. Mm-hmm. That's a very mixed message.
It is a very mixed message. And that's why Breaking Through is bringing everyone together. Anyone who's open to having this conversation and wanting to be a part of really fixing this mental health crisis, we want to talk to them because we need to talk to parents. Think about it. When you have children, you're not handed a playbook on what exactly to do. But now, how much do we know that we could share with parents, with educators, to be able to help Gen Z and Gen Alpha?
And to your point, Florida's 49th out of 50 as far as funding for mental health services. And some monies were appropriated over 2 years ago, and they were vetoed. I think it was the Zebra Coalition, which is LGBT kids. You know, so we need to have the national conversation. We need to decide what the strategy is, and then we eventually are going to have to go to policymakers to get them to understand that this is a unique and growing population of kids that need behavioral health. But we need to increase funding on top of what they're currently providing for this population specifically.
Is there cogency of that going into the 2026 legislative session starting in January?
I think, you know, fortunately, we have one legislator, Representative Plankin, who's been very active with us, and she will be involved in the local and national conversations. But as a Republican legislator, she has some influence in Tallahassee. So I don't want to make her the poster child as our advocate without her permission, but I just did.
But we do. Absolutely. So let's talk about the Breaking Through initiative. What makes this different? And talk about where the rubber hits the road insofar as an at-risk youth finding connectivity and aid.
So we're coming at it from a completely different approach. Instead of each individual, different sector dealing with it differently, and what I mean by different sector, talking about parents dealing with it alone, educators dealing with it alone, lawmakers dealing with it alone, we bring everybody together. Let's all get in the same room. Let's have the conversation together. And let's get each person's thoughts and what they can do to help change this and to make it better. And so that's where Breaking Through is very different. We had our first meeting and we had a variety in the room. We had mental health counselors. We had some lawmakers in the room. We had some business leaders, some HR directors, people that represent a lot of different areas to where they can give different input, they can give their expertise, and then we can build something from there.
And we were going to specifically part of it with faith communities involved for obvious reasons. We are going to reach out to youth groups, which makes sense.
Amy, I want to give you the last word. You're a parent.
Yes.
A lot of the times that we hear about stories like this, we hear parents say, I had no idea. Never saw this coming. There were no red flags. As a parent, how do you stay on top, stay ahead, stay engaged with your kid's life without being the overbearing parent? How do you maintain not just a level of trust, but that level of trust where your child feels that comfort that we've been talking about, overcoming that stigma to talk to you? How do you handle that? You have three children.
I do. So as someone who deals with this professionally every single day and is in the weeds in it, but also a parent, it sits in the forefront of my mind because it is a parent's worst nightmare to lose their child, especially to self-harm. And so I would say that I personally try to keep the lines of communication open with my children. And they're in all different stages of life, like I had said, you know, at 24, 21, and 15, they're in different places. Mm-hmm. I am constantly keeping the door open. And I think that's so important as a parent. And to say to them, I am on your side. I am your biggest champion. And I love you unconditionally. That is something that I, as a parent, learned so early on. And I had swore to myself, my children will know that I love them unconditionally, because I feel if they know that unconditional love is so powerful, they will come to you. And so far, you know, I have had with my children, they have each faced different issues. And my oldest, you know, when she was going through some mental health issues, she was able to come to me and she was able to talk to me and we talked through it. You know, so I think that's really important as a parent.
Amy Armstrong of Project Overdose and former state legislator Dick Batchelor are spearheading the Breaking Through initiative. We'll have links to this and the organizations previously mentioned in the segment at our website, cfpublic.org. And if you or a person you care about is experiencing a mental health crisis, help is a phone call away. 988 is a free 24/7 hotline that will provide a live voice and no judgment. If you need help, please reach out. There is more ahead on Engage. Up next, we'll gaze into the economic crystal ball of UCF's Sean Snaith as we parse out his three-year outlook on the region. You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media.
The Wrap is a podcast from Central Florida Public Media, curating the top Central Florida news stories and in-depth reporting each week. Join me, Brendan Byrne, as I bring you news headlines, deep reporting dives, and insightful conversations from the news team. A new episode of The Wrap every Friday morning. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Americans will be going into the holiday season with a dose of economic uncertainty as consumers wait to see the impacts of federal policies involving import tariffs, immigration, and the current government shutdown. Locally, trending is showing growth with distant red flags that include a growing consumer debt bubble and housing costs that show no signs of cooling. So the release of the 2025 to 2028 Florida and Metro forecast by UCF's Institute for Economic Forecasting couldn't have been better timed. Sean Snaith is the director of the Institute and author of the forecast. He joins Engage to parse out his predictions. And Sean, with only a few weeks left in the 2025 hurricane season and zero storms making landfall this year, what is the economic benefit for the region of not having to respond to a hurricane?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there, with no hurricanes making landfall, there's no storm-related damages, no infrastructure that needs to be repaired or restored. So, you know, those funds set aside at the state level to handle that just will, you know, roll over and, you know, hopefully we'll get a streak here going where, you know, we run a number of years without a hurricane impact. And then I think once that happens, we'll begin to see a little additional effects. And I'm thinking primarily homeowners insurance and those premiums.
Could you see an overall easing on a lot of the stress that's being created by homeowners insurance, say, in a 12, 24, 36-month span?
I think so. If we, you know, if we continue this streak of good luck, and it wasn't that long ago that the U.S., we had a 10-year run without any major hurricanes making landfall. So something like that would help the financial situation of these homeowner insurers. It might induce additional companies to do business or resume doing business in Florida. And so that increased competition, increased level of choice for consumers, and not having to pay out damages should put some downward pressure on homeowner insurance premiums.
You report on a robust housing market, one that is susceptible to volatility. You talk about the combination of the balance of new home starts, of existing home inventory, mortgage rates, and the demographic shift of retiring boomers. You point to a softening of the housing market becoming the new normal in Florida's economy?
Yeah, well, you know, we certainly went through an unusual time in the housing market in the post-pandemic or COVID era. You know, we saw very rapid price appreciation for a couple of years. Existing homes were going up for 2 years in a row by more than 20% year over year, existing home prices. And, you know, that was fueled in part by the Federal Reserve's monetary policy. They re-implemented the same policies that they used during the financial crisis, which was to, you know, essentially bring short-term interest rates down to zero and then pushing a tremendous amount of liquidity into the market. And so we saw sub 3% 30-year fixed mortgages for a while during that time period. And that really fueled demand. And that was coupled with population growth, which is, you know, is a feature not a bug of Florida's economy, but it was catalyzed and sort of turbocharged by people that were living in other areas that had more drastic COVID policies in place. And so, you know, they were working remotely and really could work anywhere. And so, you know, that sort of revved up in migration into the state, you know, people that were stuck in an apartment in New York City, no restaurants open, no bars, no shows, paying high rates of rent, high taxes. Florida became very attractive during that time period because we had not stuck with those draconian COVID policies that a lot of other states really held in place for an extended period.
The report also predicts a slowing of the state's gross product. To what extent do you see that slowdown impacting residents and consumers? And to what extent do you see this being impacted by federal policies like the tariff policies or the ripple effects of the crackdown on immigration?
Well, yeah, we're you know, forecasting a slowing of the national economy as well. And so Florida, while we are predicting, will continue to outgrow the national economy in terms of state GDP, real estate GDP. And also our labor market will continue to outperform the national economy. Unemployment rates are still at very low levels historically. Job growth is starting to slow. And now we're not getting data during the shutdown. So, you know, I'm sort of forecasting in a fog here. We were starting to see some of that slowdown take place. And so the immigration crackdown, I think, is going to, once we start getting that monthly jobs data reported again, I think we're going to see some unusual data coming out of that report, particularly the number of payroll jobs that companies are adding each month. I think we could see those numbers go negative, not necessarily because people are being laid off, but that flood of migration that's gone down to a trickle, basically. You know, all those people that came into the country, and I'm not talking about people that, you know, cross the border at night and nobody knows who or where they are, but those that claim asylum become eligible to get a work permit within a few months. And so, you know, all those workers that were coming in got these claims of asylum, got a work permit. Now that flow's gone away. So I think we may see some odd behavior of payroll jobs numbers. But at the same time, I think the unemployment rate stays relatively low and stable, maybe a slight drift higher. So the data is getting muddied by these unusual swings in immigration.
And to focus down even further, you're predicting above average growth in the Orlando-Kissimmee corridor based on economic indicators and above average employment growth. Well, what stands out in this region?
I've said for some time that Central Florida, you know, this I-4 corridor, you know, Tampando or Lampa, really is and has been, you know, the new breadbasket for Florida in terms of economic and job growth. And so, you know, we've been seeing for a couple of years when this labor market information comes out, Orlando, Tampa, they're always in the top three regions in the state in terms of job creation. And I think a lot of it was very fundamental. It's geography. South Florida, of course, the greater Miami metropolitan area, is still the largest in the state. It's about the size of Tampa and Orlando combined. But growth in South Florida really is just restricted by the Atlantic Ocean and the Everglades. And so historically, that growth has occurred moving north up I-95. But, you know, there are limits to that, of course, you know, the traffic and congestion, the length of commutes, et cetera. Whereas in Central Florida, you know, we don't really have that. We have, you know, the ability to kind of grow in all directions. And so, you know, we don't have that sort of physical constraint. That brings with it its own set of issues. But, you know, I'd rather have what I call growing pains than the pain of economic stagnation that many, many regions of our country live with all the time.
And finally, analysts from MoneyWise, WalletHub, Forbes, Yahoo Finance have recently been reporting that Florida is the second most distressed state in the union in terms of residents' debt obligations, second to Texas. The state saw a 23% increase in the share of people with distressed bank accounts between 2024 and 2025. Are you concerned of a consumer debt bubble developing?
Well, I am. And I mean, that's part of the reason, you know, we're forecasting a slowing of economic growth is that the consumer sector we're predicting is in a slow. So the inflation that was triggered by the Federal Reserve's policy and federal government spending in the COVID era at its peak was close to 9%. And so we haven't seen inflation that high for about 40 years in the United States. And so while the labor market was strong and wages and salaries were growing, they were not keeping pace with the cost of living. And so I think many households and typically middle, lower income households, while they still had jobs, they were still, you know, getting their paychecks. Those paychecks weren't able to cover their expenses. So, you know, you get to the end of the month, you still have expenses that need to be paid. And I think a lot of households were patching that hole in their budget by using credit cards. And so we saw, in parallel to the rise in inflation, a rise in the balance on credit cards across the country. And it stands at about $1.1 trillion. And that is coupled with average interest rates, which also went up for him this time period, that are in excess of 20%. So that burden for some households, you know, when you have the high balances and high interest rates, you know, even that minimum monthly payment becomes something that's difficult for some households to make. So we're seeing some signs of stress there, not necessarily a full-blown crisis, because as I've said, you know, people are still working. And inflation has come down, and so wage growth is now faster than the rate of inflation. So this will give households some ability to try to repair what's happening there. But, you know, it's a significant burden, no doubt.
Sean Snaith is the director of UCF's Institute for Economic Forecasting and the author of the 2025 to 2028 Florida and Metro Forecast. Coming up, a pair of brothers are turning everyday pop culture debates into March Madness-style brackets in front of live audiences. You're listening to Engage.
There's a lot going on in space, from efforts to land astronauts on the moon
and liftoff of Artemis 1
to answering the age-old question, are we alone in the universe?
Wouldn't you want to know if there was life on another planet?
Are We There Yet? Explores space exploration every Tuesday at 6:30 here on Central Florida Public Media.
You're listening to Engage on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. If the internet has taught us anything, it's that people love to rank things and argue their value. Think the never-ending clickbait listicles that clutter our social media feeds. How many times have you argued with friends about the greatest drum solo ever, the best major league bullpen in the modern era, or which Real Housewife is the witchiest? Brothers Sean and Pat Rice relocated to Orlando from suburban Philadelphia 12 years ago to work behind the scenes at Universal and Disney. During the COVID lockdowns, boredom drove them to develop a game to play during Zoom meetups. Build a playoff bracket like you'd see during the NCAA March Madness basketball tournaments. Pick a random topic and start filling in the brackets. Then let everybody participating argue their picks through playoff rounds until a winner is determined. I know this sounds kind of convoluted, so I asked Sean and Pat to explain the Bracket Brothers show to me.
So when the show starts, it's Sean and I coming out.
kind of introducing ourselves, introducing the show, breaking down what a bracket is. And then we introduce our guests, which are usually a mixture of what we consider experts on the topic, actual experts, and then usually a performer or two up there just to make everybody comfortable. And then we unleash and unveil the bracket itself, which is this giant 9-foot by 11-foot painter's tarp that I decked out with gaff tape in a carport, because the original was supposed to be a projected bracket on a screen, but the projector broke the week before our first show, which kind of happened to be a happy accident because the physicality of the bracket has kind of become its own character on stage.
There's something charming about game show props.
Yes, absolutely. And there is a level of it that is a game show. You know, there's not really winners and losers, but it becomes a competition. I think as you journey through the bracket, you realize you have a stance on something you may have not come in with, or it does become a comedy show in that there is a joke, there are callbacks. We want it to be interactive, but to a certain level. So, you know, we strategically get guests that are experts and with a following, so people want to come and see the people that they like. And then at the top of the show, we kind of set a standard of like when we want it to be kept on stage and when we want to open it to the crowd. But, you know, we encourage alcohol and getting into it and yelling out if you really love or hate something that's said. We encourage people to kind of cheer and jeer as it goes. And if we really find somebody passionate, we'll give them a microphone. We'll bring them on stage. We want the audience to be a part of the show.
And you know, once alcohol is part of the equation, I'm sure it gets more and more boisterous as the brackets go on.
Oh, absolutely. And it really doesn't matter the topic. We found you put enough people in a room, everyone has opinions about anything. We joke about eventually doing a show about bugs when the show hopefully is big enough that we don't have to do these eye-catching topics. We just want to get 100 people in the room and see how angry everybody gets when we put a beetle up against, you know, a carpenter ant.
So let's talk about these topics. What are some of the topics that resonate the most with audience? Are there topics that kind of fell flat?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, because I would have had a different answer for you before we did the shows. You know, we've done things like theme park rides and horror movies and things that people have, you know, hobbies and passions around. But honestly, I think our craziest show in terms of participation was in February. We just did couples, and this was real world couples, TV couples. Frog and Toad ended up winning, and it was probably the most boisterous, participatory. People were coming out of their seats screaming stuff when we told them to. And so it's really hard to predict where the audience is going to get really passionate. Of course, things that, you know, have a fiery fan base, like theme parks and things like that, people always bring opinions, but it has been very surprising. Sometimes the guests get really passionate about things you wouldn't expect. That's what I think makes the show really fun, is we can throw a really interesting theme out there, but the show can really make anything out of anything, which I think is where the magic is in it.
So Pat, I mean, is there like a blue sky unicorn topic that you just see blowing up the room and creating the greatest pop culture debate of all time?
God, I mean, it might be bugs. Who knows? I mean, I know I have my passion, so mine are, you know, we can argue Philadelphia sports as much as we want. That would be great, but I don't think that will speak to a room of people in Orlando, Florida. I'd love to get a little bit more physical in that maybe as we approach food and things like that, maybe there's an actual sampling to it so people can have a live reaction to it. You know, I joke about doing a soups episode and there's just a bunch of bowls of soup out there and people can come serve themselves and have an opinion immediately formed. Exact. Yeah.
We could have live bugs. There you go.
Actually, yeah, maybe that's it. We bring on like one of those guys that do birthdays and bring bugs to everybody. This might be it. But I think that's, you know, I think for me, blue sky is, it's just something that can get as interactive as possible, because you don't realize your passions or your debates or your what you want to have a stance on and until it's in your hands sometimes.
Where can you take this? Because this feels like an ideal premise for a TV show or a YouTube series.
Yeah, the number one question we get from people is, you know, where can we watch this? Where can this be streamed? Because it feels very much like a podcast, but it's not. So we started to record more of the shows. We weren't doing that at first, but Sack has been really great with, you know, helping us record shows. And so ideally we get this up somehow on YouTube or something someday, but You know, honestly, right now, it's very much just a fun thing to do. We don't really make a lot of money on this show. We put it all right back into the props because, like Pat mentioned, he built the bracket and then he ended up putting it through the wash and ruining it. So we had to build a second bracket. So it's very much a labor of love.
All right, Sean, Pat Rice, tell me about what we'll see tonight at the SAC Comedy Lab.
Yeah, so tonight is our special Halloween show. It's our one-year anniversary since bringing this up to SAC. Going to be debating the best parts of Halloween Horror Nights at Universal. And so the fun part about it, though, is, you know, you might be expecting to come and say, like, oh, what was your favorite house? Or, oh, what was your favorite show? But we will not be talking about that. We're going to be talking about what's better, the smell of fog or the relief of taking off your shoes after a night of Horror Nights? Or what's better, getting a good parking spot or seeing your friend cry from getting scared too much or something like that? So it's very much, we're going to be talking about the vibes that make Horror Nights so much fun. We have some really amazing guests, all of whom are theme park aficionados, influencers who all really specialize in Horror Nights and love the brand and horror in general. So it's going to be a spooky show, but it's going to be absurd in every way possible.
Sean and Pat Rice are the Bracket Brothers. You can catch their show tonight at 7 at the SAC Comedy Lab in Orlando. We will have links on our website, cfpublic.org. And that's all for today's edition of Engage. I'm Richard Copeland, sitting in for Sharon Stone. Thank you for joining us. All Things Considered is coming up following NPR News.